Our last case this morning is 14-67, Chesapeake Exploration, LLC et al. Versus Kenneth Buell et al. For the petitioners, we'll start with Mr. Ubersax.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. I'm here on behalf of North American Coal Royalty Company. I'm going to address the first of the certified questions, and Mr. Abbott will address the second question, and we're each going to try to reserve 1 minute of rebuttal. The first question is whether a recorded oil and gas lease of a severed mineral interest is a title transaction and therefore a savings event under the Dormant Mineral Act. The definition of title transaction is, of course, extremely broad. It's any transaction affecting title to any interest in land. So the question is, does an oil and gas lease affect title? Not does it transfer title or convey title, but does it affect title? And in the lexicon of real estate, that means, to give a few examples, to encumber, to burden, to impair, to reduce the marketability or value of title. Now, an oil and gas lease obviously does that in two ways. First of all, it affects the title to the minerals. The owner of the mineral estate is giving to the lessee the right, and usually the exclusive right, to dig up and to carry away his minerals. So the lessee can deplete the estate, he can even exhaust the estate, and he leaves the lessor with less than he had to start with, and maybe with nothing at all. Now, it's hard to imagine a more profound effect on the mineral owner's title than that. It is an encumbrance on his title, it's a cloud on his title, any potential purchaser would obviously want to know about it. That's why the lease has to be recorded. And that's why the lessee is supposed to release it when it's over, as a matter of record, so everybody knows. Now, secondly, the lease also affects the surface owner's title, because it gives the lessee typically the right to conduct operations on the surface. And that is inconsistent with the surface owner's absolute and total control of his property. So again, there's an encumbrance on the surface owner's title. So I think it's very clear that there is an effect on title, but if there were any doubt, the court ought to look at this in light of the purposes of the statute that you're now looking at for the second time today, the Dormant Mineral Act. The purpose of the act is to encourage development and production by getting rid of the interests of unknown owners or missing owners, or abandoning owners. The whole purpose of an oil and gas lease is exactly to develop and produce minerals. So the lessor...
Well, that wouldn't necessarily be the only purpose. If you bought Green Acres and you wanted Green Acres to be Green Acres forever, it also gives you the opportunity to do that, right?
Well,
if you just like looking out the window at your patch of heaven.
Well,
the Dormant Act lets you, if it qualifies,
understood.
And you own the surface rights. Gather all the bundle of sticks back together in one pile and own them all. And then.
Right, but if you enter into an oil and gas lease.
Well, sure.
Then you are manifesting your intent to preserve your interest, to develop it, and that's exactly what Ohio wants you to do. And in that situation, you know, you are not an unknown owner, your interest is a matter of record. And you're not an abandoning owner, which is, again, what the statute is looking for. If someone has got no interest in their rights, they're not going to develop them, then Ohio move them off the books. But if you've got someone who's entering into a lease and who's trying to develop and produce minerals, Ohio approves of that, and it would make there's absolutely no reason, given the purposes of the statute, why that 20-year period should run if there's an oil and gas lease that in place. This is not in any sense a dormant interest. It's something that the owner is trying to develop, or at least hopes that his lessee will develop. And more than that, not only would it be inconsistent with the statute, Your Honors, to not recognize this as a savings event, it would be an injustice, because you would end up declaring a forfeiture. You would allow a forfeiture to occur where the mineral owner has sought to develop his interest as Ohio wants him to.
You're thinking in terms of the oil and gas valuable interests that are being developed and folks want to see developed in this state. But a lot of those interests were severed or separated from the surface and the subsurface over coal. That was what was anticipated to be developed. And then the economics of that, or the ability to determine whether there's valuable coal there or not, may have changed. And this act would also let a surface owner put everything back together, because nothing's ever going to happen mm-hmm. with respect to what was anticipated in the first place.
Well, there's certainly no question that the act does reunite ownership of the surface and of the minerals in appropriate circumstances. And those circumstances exist where the mineral owner has abandoned his interest. He has shown through his inaction that he's got no interest in doing anything. That is basically against public policy in Ohio. We want our minerals to be developed. So when the lessor shows by entering into an oil and gas lease that he's trying to develop his property, that is a savings event.
Counsel, I'm trying to figure out, I'm trying to do math up here, and it's difficult for me. If we were to answer the certified question, number one, as a yes, and someone entered into a 20-year lease, at the end of the 20 years, the mineral rights have been expired, does that trigger another 20 years? The expiration. Are we talking about 40 years here or 20 years on a garden variety lease?
Well, in that situation, we would be talking potentially about 40. And Mr. Abbott will address your question exactly, which is what happens upon the expiration of a lease. Our position is that too, is a title transaction. It's the reverse of the lease, and so has essentially the same effect upon title. I see that my time is...
Is there any filing that's done at the end of the, or at the expiration of the lease?
There is supposed to be a filing. Yeah, there's supposed to be a filing by the lessee of the expiration or termination of the lease.
And did that happen here?
That didn't happen in this particular case. So far as we know, we haven't been able to find a filing of
record. Is that problematic?
It is not problematic. In terms of the effect, the legal effect of the expiration under the Dormant Mineral Act, it's still a transaction that took place. It still affected title.
But it has to say, under the section, it has to be filed or recorded to be within the Act. Under 5301, 56, B3A.
Correct. A title transaction does have to be recorded.
That's the section you want us to look at, that specific section.
Exactly.
That's all you're asking us to do in terms of this question, to decide whether filed oil and gas leases fall within the section or not, and then whether a revocation that is also filed comes within that same section.
Right. And they both fall. And even if there's not a separate filing of the termination or the expiration of the lease, it is still a matter of record. It is recorded through the lease itself. And that's an important point, that the lease records or puts on record both the terms of the lease and the terms of its expiration. So anybody who's searching the record will see that the lease is set to expire or has expired, and someone searching title can find the exact circumstances of
and,
that.
And we're talking about a five-year lease. This was the last lease on the land?
In 1984, that was the last lease, and it lasted until 1989.
All right. And then the mineral rights were transferred to North American and recorded in 08. Is that correct?
There was a quitclaim, yes, by the Bel Air Corporation to North American Coal Royalty Company.
All right. Is that part of the sequence of transactions that affect the title?
Well, it was our position that any sale of the surface that restates the mineral reservation would also be the title transaction and a savings event, and there were numerous of those in the record here. The district court did not accept our position on that issue. And there is some controversy in Ohio law. Courts are divided on that.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Abbott, you've got a little more than 4 minutes.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, my name is Kevin Abbott. I represent Chesapeake and the other lessees in this case. The second question is the expiration of the lease and the reversion of rights granted by that lease. Also, a title transaction, in other words, the subject of a transaction affecting title, so as to start a 20-year period under the Act.
Is there a separate filing that actually occurs, a filing and a recording?
No, in this case, I believe the record, Your Honor, is there was no separate recording of the reversion. It's our position that the energetics case out of Michigan, the Michigan Supreme Court, answered that specific question. The lease itself is a recorded transaction of both the initial beginning of the lease and the reversion. It's a typical garden variety lease. It is a five-year lease, primary term. It has a secondary term that can be infinite, so long as oil and gas are produced. That lease itself gives a title searcher all the information they need and all the notice they need to know that they have to go find out, was that lease, did it expire or was it reverted? So you don't need a separate filing under the Act. One recorded transaction can serve both purposes. And that's what the Michigan Court.
And you're saying that one recorded transaction of that lease, and that was when, 2000 and?
No, Your Honor, 1984 lease is the one I'm talking about.
1984, but that was for a five-year period?
Five-year primary term, and then so long as oil and gas are produced.
And oil and gas is being produced.
Well, it was not under that lease. My clients got a lease in 2009, and they did drill a well under the lease, not on this particular property, but it's a 3,000-acre lease. So they did drill a well. They did invest quite a bit of money.
But you're mentioning a Michigan case, though. We're talking about an Ohio law here.
Right. And the Michigan statute actually is more restrictive than Ohio. In Michigan, there was a requirement that you have a transfer, an actual transfer. And that court found that the lease document itself was both the initial transfer and the reversion, because it is a property interest and that reversion is contained in the lease. And the Ohio—
Without an additional requirement of filing
actually,
at the reversion.
Actually, Michigan law has—yes, Your Honor, the answer is yes. Michigan has the same requirement of recording a release as Ohio.
But we don't have a recorded release here.
We don't, and they did not in the energetics case. The court found there that the recorded lease itself served both purposes.
Counsel, I guess that's where I'm having trouble, particularly on the certified question number two. I think everybody in the room understands that if you enter into a lease and you encumber your land, that is a title transaction. That has happened. I do not understand when the 5 years has ended or the 20 years has ended. Why is that a title transaction? Nothing has happened.
Actually, something did happen. The exact same rights that were conveyed the first time, the exclusive right to produce for oil and gas, to take away those minerals. At the end of the lease, there is a reversion. There was a reversionary interest in the lease. Those same things went back. It's like the reverse of the first transaction. It's the same thing going back.
I understand. I'm wrestling with the English language, though. I understand as a matter of law, when a lease expires, it is over. That part I understand.
Right.
I don't understand why that is a transaction, because when I look at the English language, a transaction is when Party A and Party B say, let's make a deal.
And I would say, Your Honor, the Act does not require specific conveyance. Michigan required an actual transfer. All that the Ohio Act requires is a transaction, which I would describe as, and I think we put a definition in our brief, any activity between two persons, and it has to be the subject of that transaction.
I was using your term, and I don't see the activity between persons when a calendar page by itself flips.
The activity was between the lessee and the mineral rights owner.
Now, are you saying it's just they changed their status? They changed their relationship to one another?
Correct.
They changed their relationship to the asset?
But there's no filing or recording of that transaction. I mean, think of a mortgage, for example. We have mortgage releases then that are filed and recorded to let everyone know that searches the title that there has been a change. Here, you're suggesting that the lease itself does that without anything further being filed or recorded.
Yes, and I have to go back to the purpose of the Dormant Mineral Act. It is a very narrow exception to the common law. At the common law, if I severed the minerals from the property, I took that stick out of the bundle, it is out of the bundle of the surface owner forever. There's no getting it back. The problem that the Dormant Mineral Act addressed was that sometimes because of the sands of time or whatever, they could not locate or they could not find a mineral owner. So that meant that they would not want to invest the money to drill a well. And so the Dormant Mineral Act was actually proposed by the industry, and it was just to address that problem where I can't find the mineral interest owner, and therefore I need to have that right abandoned. So in that instance, you could abandon and you would reunite the surface. The lease itself is evidence of both a transaction and a reversionary interest. So the recording of the release, to me, clearly would be a title transaction and would start the 20 years. However, we think that the Michigan court got it right, that the reversion itself is also a title transaction.
So you're saying
it's
not—
the 20 years.
Yes, Your Honor.
The termination resets the 20 years in your—
Yes.
Your look.
And you're saying it's not customary at all ever to file reversions of leases?
I don't want to.
Does that mean that the idea of the resetting of the clock,
right,
seeing it in the record as a filing, a recording, that shows everyone, yes, we are now resetting the clock, and you're saying that that's not necessary?
I'm saying it's not necessary under the Dormant Mineral Act. It is required by statute to release it, but that's usually a different issue and a different purpose. That's where usually the mineral interest owner or the lessor wishes to lease it to someone else, and they want it released by the first.
So by not filing it, is there a cloud on the title? If at the end of the lease there is no release, or end of the lease, there is no acknowledgement of the termination of that lease through that release?
I think you could look at it that way. I mean, if a release was actually filed, I think there's no doubt that the 20 years starts. This situation is a little bit harder where there is no release.
You're just saying it happens by operation of law.
Correct, Your Honor. And
is that the analysis of Energetics, or is it different? I haven't read the case.
That is the analysis is that it occurs by operation of law, and it's in the terms of the lease. And a trained title searcher would know, I've got an oil and gas lease here. They're not going to depend on whether or not a release has been filed. They're going to make further inquiries as to did that lease terminate or did it not.
But then the lease could go on if there's an active oil and gas well on the property. Is that what we're saying?
Correct, and that's why you always have to make further inquiry. Even if there's
so if there's no release on file, if I'm a title examiner, am I presuming then that this lease is continuing and it's a valid lease?
I do not believe you would presume that, Your Honor. I think in every case they make further inquiries. They go to the property, they contact the lessee of record, the mineral interest owner of record. And that was a point that the Energetics Court made. The Dormant Mineral Act was not created to be a substitute for title searches. It was not meant to be like a one-stop shopping for title. It's basically a notice statute, and it was only addressed at the situation where you did not know who the mineral interest owner was. And in this particular case, North American was the known mineral interest owner since, I think, 1958. So that was always known. So I think that the release, the subject of the release, just isn't an issue here. And I would ask the court to look at the Energetics case. Their statute is much more restrictive. But they found it was a reversion and it was a transfer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Corrado.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Gary Corrado from Zangas Plaquis Manus on behalf of the respondents. I'd like to start this morning actually with certified question number two, because I think the panel has raised some important questions and some important issues there. If we look at the purpose of the Ohio Dormant Mineral Rights Act, there really is two purposes. First is the overarching policy in the state of Ohio to encourage and promote the production of natural resources in the state. The second purpose of the act is to provide clear record, public record title to mineral ownership interests. And something that is not recorded, and a transaction that is not recorded, runs afoul of not only the purpose of the act, which is to provide clear record title, it also runs afoul of the plain language of the statute that requires the title transaction in no uncertain terms to be recorded in the county recorder's office in the county where the lands are located.
And you're talking about the termination of the lease, or the ending of the lease?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm talking about the ending of the lease.
And so you think the fact that it has not been recorded will necessitate the answer of no to question two, certified question two?
Yes, I think that alone necessitates that answer. I think it actually goes, though, beyond that.
Would it make a difference if it were recorded?
I believe it would not. And the reason that I believe it would not is because the expiration of the lease is not a transaction. This notion that there's somehow a reversionary interest or there's some grant back to the lessor under a lease when the lease expires simply doesn't appear in these leases.
Well, counsel, the reality is in Ohio, I mean, I guess I'm showing my age here, but there's thousands of leases that were entered into in the 80s in the first boom, correct? And a vast majority of them never had any termination affidavit signed by anyone, correct?
Correct.
And that's just the reality, isn't it?
Yes. The reality is that a lot of these things are, although they're supposed to be recorded, they're not.
And the reality is that no driller in his right mind would ever enter into a lease until they got an affidavit from someone that there was no gas well on this land.
That's correct, that there was no production, there's been no royalties paid. That's what the driller would require. But I think what's important here as to this argument that, well, the recorded lease serves as notice to everyone as to when the expiration takes place. I would submit to this court that, as a practical aspect, it is virtually impossible for a title examiner under an oil and gas lease to determine under certain circumstances whether that lease has expired. If we look at the lease here, let's go to the 2009 lease. the most recent lease, which isn't the savings event at issue here. But if we look at the provisions of that lease has a what they call a five-year primary term. But it also has a delay rental provision, which says if a well is not drilled in the first 12 months of that 5 years, in order to continue the lease, the lessee has to make an annual payment to the lessor. So even during that first 5 years, a title examiner will have to see, well, maybe it's expired. Maybe they haven't drilled a well. Maybe they haven't made the payment. So now they've got to inquire as to whether a well's been drilled, whether those payments have been made. And that's just during the first 5 year period. It actually gets more convoluted because the lease can continue beyond the 5 years upon the happening. And I think in this lease, there's six different events. One is the production of oil and gas. They might be able to tell that. Another one of the events is if a well is drilled and it is capable of producing in the mind of the lessee, then the lease continues for so long as the lessee in their subjective mind believes they can produce that well. Now, how is a title examiner or any member of the public ever going to determine from one day to the next whether that particular provision has been satisfied?
So it's the mere filing of the transaction that is sufficient, in your view, the filing and recording of the lease?
Well, in my view, even the recording isn't sufficient because the expiration is not a transaction. I'd like to address that
right,
next.
Right, of the expiration, but I'm saying the lease itself. You don't look to the content. It's the lease is the transaction, and then if you're going to revoke it, you need to file something else, as I said, similar to a mortgage release.
The lease, I would not agree that a lease is a title transaction under the statute, and I'll talk about that in a moment. The lease is a contract between the parties. It gets recorded. So it's a transaction in the sense that it's a contract between these two parties. It gets recorded. But that's the transaction. The expiration, all that happens at an expiration is the rights that I have granted to the lessor, they don't exist anymore. They expire. If you look at, for example,
they revert back to the surface owner or whoever, maybe not the surface owner, but whoever owned the mineral rights to lease them.
Actually, Your Honor, I don't agree that there's a reversion back. If you look at the lease agreement and
if I own the mineral rights and I lease them to you, do I have an interest in those mineral rights during the term of the lease?
Oh, you clearly continue to still have and own all those mineral interests. All I've granted,
I've given away the ability to develop them.
That's correct. And those rights and obligations.
Isn't that an asset, the ability to develop those mineral rights?
Well, it's a right. It's a right, and there's an obligation, like under any contract. If I contracted with you to perform some other services for me, we have rights and obligations under that contract. When that contract ends, whatever rights I've given you, there's not a grant back to me or a reversion.
Who has the rights at the expiration then?
The landowner has them because the rights that I now have given to you as the landowner, Your Honor, have expired. You no longer have rights and obligations.
If you own the property,
yes,
and you grant rights to mine assets to a second party for a period of time, at the expiration of the period of time, which party, in your view, has the right to extract the minerals?
The lessor. Because your right to do it has now expired.
The one who made the grant. So they revert back to the grantor.
Counsel.
Isn't that right?
No. Your rights expire, is my position. And if you look at the way it's couched in the terms of leases, if you look at the surrender and look at a lease.
The right to extract expires, and who then has the right to extract?
The person who granted it.
Property owner.
Okay. Property owner.
And counsel,
like in any other contract, when a contract expires, the rights that I've granted you under the contract, you no longer have.
And I think what we're arguing about here is use of a term I'm unfamiliar with the use of the term reversion at the termination of a term of a lease. And that's really what you're arguing is they want to, the other side wants to use the term reverts And really what you're talking about is the property owner has given up certain rights in their property for a time certain. And when the time's up, the time's up. And that's not a reversion. The property owner always owned the full rights of the property at the end of the term, because they didn't transfer those unless certain other activities.
That's exactly right. There's an expiration of the rights that were granted,
so
not a
we're
reversion.
Quarreling about the use of two words. You say expiration is the right word, they say reversion is the right word.
And I think the language in a lease actually supports the use of the term expiration, because that's what leases talk about. There's a grant from the lessor, you know, I'm going to lease to you the rights to come on the property, the rights to develop, et cetera, for this certain period of time. But there's nothing that says, and at the end of this lease, all rights granted shall revert back, or the lessee at the end of this lease.
Well, isn't that the practical result here is that you get 100% of those rights, whereas when the lease was in effect, you had less than 100% of the rights associated with mineral development, the mineral rights.
That there are certain rights as it relates to the minerals that I could no longer exercise because I've granted those exclusive rights to somebody else.
You don't own 100% of the mineral rights. When you lease the mineral rights, you are giving away for a set period of time a portion of your rights.
Actually, I would not agree with that. If I lease, I still own 100% of my mineral rights, subject to whatever rights I have allowed somebody else to have. So, for example, I can, as a property owner with an oil and gas lease on my property, sell my property, surface, oil and gas rights, and everything to a third party.
Mm-hmm.
100% of my oil and gas rights. Now, they take that, but they take it subject to whatever contract I have with lease. Likewise, I could sell only my mineral interests.
Counsel, that brings me to the question you answered earlier. I'm not sure I understand it. I'm back to the English language again. When you then give someone the property rights to your property, say for 5 years, how do you get us to the point where that is not a title transaction?
Okay.
Because it clearly is clouding the title, and it clearly, as your answer to the chief is, diminishing the property owner's rights in that land.
And so, and we'll move, that's question number one, certified question number one, and we'll move to that, Your Honor. I think there's a couple ways that that happens. First of all, we have to look at that issue in the context of the words that the legislature chose and the way they drafted this statute. And so I think the first reason that that's not a title transaction is based upon the plain language of the statute. The statute says that the savings event is when the mineral interest has been the subject of a title transaction. Mineral interest under the statute is defined as a fee interest in at least one mineral. And it has to be the subject of a title transaction. And in the original version of the Act, the definition that was in front of the General Assembly included lease among those items that would constitute a title transaction that would trigger this savings event. When the statute was adopted, that provision was not adopted. The legislature instead used the already existing definition under the Marketable Title Act, which says it's any transaction action affecting a title interest. The legislature did not do that in a vacuum. I mean, they understood that one of the major ways that rights are granted as it relates to oil and gas are through leases. But they chose explicitly not to include lease in that definition, and they could have. But they did address leases. And where they addressed it is in the further section down, where it talks about a savings event when a lease is involved happens when there's oil or gas or minerals produced under lands covered by a lease. So I believe that the legislature had leases in mind, and they understood that in order to further the dual purposes of the Act, which one is production of natural resources, they understood that the execution and recording of a lease in and of itself does not serve that purpose. In this very, a lease is a double-edged sword.
They have to be producing in order for a lease to be a transaction.
That's what the legislature has said. In order for a lease to be a savings event under this statute, there has to be production under that
lease.
And
that will qualify it as a title transaction.
So
in year one, they're not producing, year two, three, but in year four, they're starting to produce. And so year four is when there is a title transaction, when that lease can be qualified as a title transaction.
No, the lease itself is never a title transaction.
So, counsel, you're taking issue with what co-counsel has said. Co-counsel suggests that the first certified question should be answered yes, because under 3A, it was under 3A. You're saying no, it's under 3B. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that a lease is never a title transaction under the definitions in this statute. Because let's remember what this list is. It's a list of savings events that restart the 20-year clock. One of those savings events is a title transaction.
A title transaction would be it affects the title, right?
It affects fee ownership.
All right.
If
if I have the property, I'm both the surface and the mineral rights owner, right? And then I lease the mineral rights for 10 years. And in year 8, I decide to sell my property. Do I not have to put on the deed the fact that there is a mineral rights are, that this property is being transferred and there is a mineral rights lease?
There would be subject to any leases, et cetera, of record.
Does it affect the title to the property in the new owner?
It doesn't affect the owner's fee title interest in the minerals because I've just conveyed them, and I've conveyed them 100%. Now, they're subject to this contract or this lease, but I still have fee ownership. And remember, the definition of mineral interest under the statute is fee interest in the minerals. I've just transferred that fee interest to a third party. Now it's subject to this other provision.
Yeah. Well, maybe I asked it incorrectly, but we're talking about the abandonment portion of the statute here.
Correct.
And you're saying that under B1, that's where it talks about the subject of the title transaction. Okay, subject of title transaction. You're saying the lease is not covered there, but then if you go to B, you talk about the actual production under the lease, and you say that's where that's covered. Is that correct?
Because the legislature didn't want to make the mere execution and recording of a lease a savings event that restarts the 20-year clock, because a lease is a double-edged sword.
Why not?
Because a lease is a double-edged sword. It could be used as the first step in potentially producing minerals and oil and gas, but it also can be used to hold property for decades and decades without any production. And that happened in this case. We have a 1974 lease and a 1980 or 89 lease.
And that goes back to if we agree with your premise that the purpose here, and you said the number one purpose is to encourage production of natural resources, and secondarily, it's clear public notice as to the ownership rights. And I would disagree. I would say that the ultimate goal would be so that the public's on notice as to who owns this property and what their status is in relationship to both the mineral and the surface. And secondarily, there's this vehicle in place so that you can have production, and the production is separate from the surface ownership, which is proven to be a practical vehicle for economic development.
Well, I think that clarity in title is one of the purposes, but to what end? Mm-hmm. Clarity in title so that minerals can be produced, we know
or
who to
not.
Go to.
According
who
to you know, or, Justice Pfeiffer's position, you may just want clarity in title to ensure that nobody is going to develop those mineral rights, that you want to keep Green Acre green.
But we need to understand the statute, and I'm trying to understand your position on A, the meaning of the the mineral interest being subject of a title transaction filed or recorded. In your view, is it only the sale that would be within A, the sale of property within A?
It would be a transfer of deed. It would be those types of ownership type of transactions that are actually identified in the Marketable Title Act.
So let's say just a sale of property with boilerplate in it that says mineral interest, reservation of mineral interest. To you, that would fall within A?
Yes, if I'm transferring the property to you and reserving to myself the mineral interest, then that would qualify as a title transaction under A.
Or if it said just the opposite, without mineral interests. If it's
correct.
In the deed, you're saying deeds are covered under A, leases are covered under B, and this is all part of the section relating to the abandonment of when we're talking about surface owner and so on.
Right, because leases could have been addressed as part of A. They could have put in the definition. They didn't. Right. They address it because the important thing is production under a lease.
Or you could do a quick claim deed, which just says I'm selling to you whatever I own.
That's right, and that would be
figure
a title,
that out.
And that would be a title transaction.
Back to the statute. You indicate that when we get into all the record in this, we're going to discover that the General Assembly, the bill that was introduced, would have included leases as a savings event, and they took that out.
That's correct, Your Honor. Actually, it's in Respondent's Appendix. At Appendix page 00216 is that version of the statute, and it says the interest has been conveyed, leased, transferred, or mortgaged by an instrument filed or recorded in the recorder's office of the county in which the lands are located. That was the original draft version of the statute that was not adopted. Now, interestingly enough, when we talk about the Energetics case, Energetics does adopt that definition, and in coming to their conclusion was looking at an entirely different statutory construction. If I might have 1 minute to address the Harris case, which I know has found its way into a lot of this briefing on this issue about whether or not a lease transfers a property interest, and many of these parties have relied upon the 1897 decision of this court in Harris to say that, well, an oil and gas lease transfers a property interest. But I would urge the court to take a very careful look at Harris, because I don't believe that it actually stands for that proposition. And I think the reasoning there is consistent with what I've described to the court today, is what I think the statutory intent was with a lease having to do more than just execute it and record it. If you look at Harris, and in that decision at page 130, the court talks about that in this case, possession was delivered and operations commenced, wells drilled, and oil produced in paying quantities. And in such cases where there's production, oil produced and in such cases, it cannot be doubted the lease has vested, though limited, some estate in the lands for those purposes. But the court goes on to say, what the exact rights of the parties were after execution of the lease and before oil was found in paying quantities is now immaterial. And it doesn't talk about whether or not that creates some sort of ownership interest in the leased property to the lessee. And it even goes on to further distinguish there might be a difference between oil leases and gas leases because of the nature of production. So I know the Harris case is thrown around quite often as just a, well, clearly the Harris decision found that an oil and gas lease is a property right. But I think if you look at the reasoning, it doesn't rise to a property right until there is production. The same thing that the legislature was trying to require under a lease before there was going to be any savings event associated with the lease. So I've used my time. I thank you for
your
patience.
And your position on question one is the answer should be
no.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you. Very briefly, there's been much discussion about the release not being filed in this particular case. I think the key point is not whether it was actually filed, but that it was supposed to be filed. And that reflects the legislature's recognition that the termination of the lease, no less than the entry into a lease, is a title transaction of which the world should be put on notice. So
isn't the key here that a mineral interest means a fee interest? I mean, it's very clear that that's what A3 defines mineral interest as, a fee interest.
Well, it has always been understood as a fee interest. The question here is whether the lease affects a fee interest.
That's not what the statute says, though, is it?
Well, the statute says that a savings amount is a title transaction is any transaction affecting title to any interest in land. And so here the question is there an effect upon the mineral interest, which is a fee interest, no question about it. There is an effect insofar as the lease burdens or encumbers that fee interest.
So the release of that encumbrance triggers a transaction.
It is indeed a transaction itself. It's a reversion to the original owner of the rights that he gave to the lessee. Mr. Corrado suggested that the mineral owner keeps all of his rights when he enters into a lease, but that is simply not the case. He's confusing a conventional or ordinary real estate lease with an oil and gas lease, and the cases are very clear that these are different things. In a normal situation, the lessor does retain title. If he rents an apartment, for example, he's going to get it back at the end of the term, and that is not true with oil and gas leases. The lessor may get nothing back at the end of the lease. He may get less back than he originally owned. He's actually giving up the biggest stick in his bundle of rights, and that's the oil and gas. And that's why the cases have recognized that what is given up in a lease is a fee simple determinable in the oil and gas. Now, I know this court has never used that exact term, but in the Indian Camp case, it did recognize that a severed mineral interest created by lease, as well as by other means, creates a fee simple estate. And of course, we know that the estate is determinable. It ends when the lease is over. So what you have then is a reversion of a fee simple interest to the lessor at the end of the lease. That's what the district court here characterized as a reversion. It is not just an expiration or ending, but a reversion of all those rights that the lessor gave up when he entered into the agreement in the first place.
What was your authority for the fee simple determinable resolution? What was that citation?
That's the Moore. Well, this court, again, has never used that precise term, but it has said fee simple in the Moore against Indian Camp case from 1907, I believe it
Thank
was.
You.
And of course, the Ninth District Court of Appeals in the Kramer case, following up on the many decisions of this court, saying that an oil and gas lease is not a mere license, that it actually gives vested rights and property. I mean, every time this court has looked at that question, it's come out the same way. There's three decisions where the court has unequivocally said, this is not just a license. This is creating vested rights in property. And so that happens at the beginning of the lease. It happens at the end of the lease when those vested rights are given back to the property owner. Both are transactions.
They're revested.
Exactly.
So your opposing counsel would say that they never left the bundle of the property owner.
Well, we just have a disagreement about that. I mean, they clearly...
That's central here to this question.
Well, it's not necessarily central because all that this court has to decide is whether the lease or the termination of the lease affects title. It doesn't actually have to transfer an interest. And our point is that it affects title insofar as it burdens or encumbers that title and something that a buyer ought to know about. Even if this is just a license, let's say it's just a license, it doesn't transfer any title. It still affects title because it allows the lessee or the licensee or whatever you call them to take away the minerals for all time, and that he can diminish the owner's estate. That is a profound effect on title.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for